Dargrave Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn Semester 2009. This is Business Finance FIL 240, Section 6. Lecture 23, delivered on November 12, 2009. The title of this lecture is Review for Exam 2.
Today, Review for Exam 2. It will have the same format as Exam 1, a multiple choice section, then a matching section, then a problem workout section, and then a short answers section. Now, I anticipate that where you will have the most difficulty is, of course, in the short answers. That's going to be typical. You are, however, better informed about that section. And I'll put a little bit of meat into what's going to be in there at the in the last part of this review. First, let me do the math part of the review. Well, actually, I could just hand around the exam so you could see it here. No, you wouldn't want to see it. Okay. Yeah, really. Bring it on, Teach. No, it's not in final form yet here. What I often do will write an exam, and then I'll take it myself, and I'll say, nah, this is taking me too long. It's 60 minutes, and obviously there will be some things that you would have done in a quiz kind of environment or a take-home homework kind of thing that I would not go fully into in an exam. So let me go through the quantitative section of it first and lay out for you what you will see. Now, some of this might be a little bit combined, but there is, make no mistake about it, I will have you calculate present value and future value of annuity. Now, I won't take you into the really more difficult problems where you have to shift the annuity. Part of it occurs later, and then you have to take the present value of the annuity and then take the present value of that back to the present. I'm not going to do anything like that. It'll be just straight up, find the present value of an annuity, find the future value of an annuity. And I always like to throw in find a mortgage payment. Those are really easy to do. Once you get the hang of your calculator, those shouldn't take you more than just a minute or two. So you stay frosty on that stuff. Just get it done and move on. Now, I'll also have you do a bond pricing and bond yield. Pricing and yield. And again, if you know how to do it, it's not complicated. If you don't know how to do it, it can kill you. One, I'll give you, well, here's the bond, and here's its here's the discount rate to use. Find the price. I might ask you, well, is it selling at a discount or a premium to par or something like that? And then I'll do the reverse where I'll say, well, here's the price of a bond. Here's all the other specs. Now find the yield on the bond. Find the yield on the bond. So it'll be both of those sides of the coin. And again, that is mechanical stuff. Don't make that hard. That's not where it gets difficult. And I will do an NPV and IRR problem. And again, if you know how to pump it into your calculator, these are not hard at all. If you don't, it can take you a long time. And I'm measuring time on the exam against the use of a calculator. So if you're not planning to use a calculator, if you don't know how to, you can take a long time and you'll overrun your time allotment of 60 minutes. Oh, I'll have you do a break-even analysis. And then stock price. And finally, I'll have you do a marginal cost of capital problem. Here's the deal with that. You will have the information on the web Sunday night. just like I've done before. And all I'll be asking you on the exam is to find the break points and the marginal costs of capital. Okay? I won't have you do the investment opportunity schedule and all that kind of stuff. All I'll have you do is find the breakpoints and the marginal costs of capital for this exam. You won't have to do the graphs and decide which project to take on and all of that. All I'm doing, again, I'll give you the information Sunday night. And then on the exam, I will ask you for the breakpoints. And there, in this case, there will be two breakpoints. There will be two breakpoints. So in other words, what I'm going to do is I'm going to have the cost of debt jump at some point, and then you run out of internally generated equity at some point. Okay? It won't be anything that you haven't seen before. It's just that you'll see both kinds of money that are normally raised by a company run out, and then you'll have to pay more after it runs out. Classic optimal capital structure. I'll give you that capital structure. Just crank through it. Make it mechanical. Don't make it complicated for yourself. It's actually very straightforward. The hardest part will just be, don't make a mistake for God's sake when you calculate your costs of equity and costs of debt. As long as you don't make a mistake there, then the breakpoints are easy and the marginal cost of capital is easy. You can just clock through them. And you'll have all the information. You can work it out at home in with leisure, sitting in your underwear, eating bonbons, and drinking sodas. Okay? Yeah.
Is that the only problem that we're going to have all the information for, or are you giving us?
No, that will be the only problem. Okay. That will be the only. I'm glad you asked that. This is the one, and the reason is the other stuff you can pump in pretty quickly. But this, it's the depth of the information can get you. On an exam where you're already feeling under pressure, it's like, where do I start? If you're at home, you can get yourself underway, and you can say, oh, I know how to do this. I can look at my notes, work through this, I see, and all that. But I am glad you asked that. Yeah, this will be the only problem where I give you the information. The other ones, annuities, bond prices, stock price, yields, break-even, NPV, IRR, that stuff you can just... It's just basically pull the information out of the problems context and crank it into your calculator. That's the quantitative part. And it you can tell that it's a robust part, and it'll take your time. Just make sure you don't make any calculator mistakes, and you should be able to crank through it fairly quickly and fairly efficiently. Again, the worst thing, the thing that I worry about the most, aside from just pushing in a number wrong, is the marginal cost of capital problem. Watch out. Remember where the big stumbling block was. Did I give you D1 or did I give you D0? When you were, and is, remember that? In one problem, I had given you next year's dividend. In another problem, I gave you this year's dividend. So know which one I notice. Watch for that. And if you still get it wrong, I'll give you a wedgie. Grr. Okay. Let's go real back here. The multiple choice questions. There'll be a number of them would be of a quantitative nature, or they would address things that are quantitative in the background. Okay, let me try throw something at you. Something, a hard question. Let me throw one of the hardball multiple choice at you. And that can give you an idea of how robust it's going to get. The marginal cost of capital is below the weighted average cost of capital. What can you say about the weighted average cost of capital? Again, the marginal cost of capital is below the weighted average cost of capital. What can you say about the weighted average cost of capital? WACC is falling. WACC is at its minimum. WACC is at its maximum. WACC is rising. Okay, again, marginal cost of capital is below weighted average cost of capital. What can you say about the weighted average cost of capital? WACC, weighted average cost of capital, is falling. Weighted average cost of capital is at its minimum. Weighted average cost of capital is at its maximum. Or weighted average cost of capital is rising. It should be right in your notes. That would be really a burly one. That would be at the top of the chain to separate the people who are going on for MBAs maybe from the ones who are happy with their bachelor's degrees. I don't know. That's as tough as it would get. And then I might ask you some questions about, in the multiple choice, that would be where I could ask you things about degree of leverage, degree of operating leverage, degree of combined leverage, financial leverage. I could ask you things like that in there. Go ahead.
What was the answer? Was it falling?
I can't tell you that. I can't tell you that. Yes, it is review. Well, let me ask you this. Okay, let me ask you this. What do you think the answer is?
I think it's falling.
Why?
Because I know the curve
looks
like that. I can
drive. Let me put a little more depth, and I'll go back to what I did in the original. The reason I'm being cagey here is because I could very well ask exactly that question on the exam, and I'm sure not going to give you the answer, but let's try this. Okay, I said that the marginal cost of capital, the cost of your last dollar, is below the weighted average cost of capital. So if I've got an average, and it's like 70% on an exam, and now I throw in a marginal, the last score, that is a 50%, someone from Decatur, okay, so what's that going to do to the average after I throw it in? Is it going to make the average rise, stay the same, max out, min out, or fall? Yes, yes, it will make it fall. That's as far as I'm going to go with giving you the answer to that one. No doubt about it. But if you think about it that way, though, these in economics, I don't know how your economics was, but they usually tear you up with that relationship between marginal cost and average cost and all that. It's really not that hard once you think about it in terms of, well, if I throw in something that's below the average, it pulls the average down. If I throw in something that's above the average, it pulls the average up. That kind of stuff. Okay, well, that's as robust as I might get. And then, like I said, I could ask you about degree of operating leverage, degree of financial leverage, and degree of combined leverage, something along that line. And I say to you, here's some numbers. Which of the following would be the degree of operating leverage? Or I might say, okay, here's the degree of operating leverage, and here's the degree of combined leverage. Which of the following is the degree of financial leverage? Now, you should be able to find that in about 10 seconds on your calculator if you know the formula. You know the formula, you use, oh, well, is it that easy? Yes, it might be that very well that easy. But if you don't know the formula, you could go 5 times around the barn to get to the outhouse and end up down at the Walmart asking if you could use their public restrooms, which are nasty sometimes. Don't do that. Other questions let me throw it out to you just briefly. Do you have anything that you think I might ask in the multiple choice section of the exam? Is there anything that you think I might ask? Or you would like to ask if I would ask? And I can be straight up on it if it's something that's very complicated or very simple. Sometimes I can just say yes or no. No, I wouldn't ask you about that kind of stuff. Okay. Oh, now there's an interesting thing. Could I possibly ask a question about the difference between internal and externally generated equity? Especially, what is the big difference between internally generated and externally generated equity? From a financial management perspective, what's the big difference?
Risk.
Yeah?
No,
externally generated costs more. Why? Because you have to pay the stupid brokers a flotation cost.
But I thought you said that you want to borrow more debt externally.
No, we're talking about equity. If I have got money that I've already earned in the company, that's going to cost me less than if I have to go out and sell stock. Because I sell the stock, I have to pay the brokers, the lawyers, the promoters, and all manner of other dog beaters and cat stranglers. And that means that there's less money for me, which means that the ultimate cost of that capital is higher. Once I've burned through my earnings, net income after dividends, then I have got to go out there and beg for money in the capital markets. And I'm going to have to pay for that money. And that's going to cost me more. Good choice. Good choice for a question. Would you like to try for $1,000, Alex? anything else? Try to think what else. Without giving away go ahead. Oh yeah. There would be an M&M. Actually, there could be one in multiple choice, but I promise you, I will give you one of those in the short answer. I will give you a question on the M&M proposition in the short answers. It is not a hard proposition. It's actually a simple proposition. Just know what they said, what they found. Under standard reasonable assumptions, what did they say about capital structure? And obviously, what they said is not what we see in the real world. So clearly, that indicated to us that we had to think a little bit more about what our assumptions are when we deal with real-world situations. There's a place for that in a multiple-choice kind of question, and there's also a definite place for that in a short answer. Now, again, I emphasize in the short answers, answer the question in one complete sentence. You should never have to go more than one complete sentence to answer a question that I give you. Now, the reason I do it that way is this. When you get out into the business world, when some manager or superior to you, or even one of your peers or subordinates asks you a question, he or she does not want a dissertation. He or she wants a straight, compact, meaningful answer. And that's part of the way I teach. And if you get me in other courses, you're going to see the same thing. Say what you have to say, and then move on to something else. And that's why I do it this way. Give me a compact answer. I promise you that every one of the questions that I ask you in that last section can be answered in one compact sentence. Sometimes it's a very short sentence. Sometimes it's a longer sentence. But it doesn't require a dissertation to answer those questions. I want you to focus on what is meaningful. And yes, this time, I will pull out the bullshit stamp. I told you I have a bullshit stamp. It will be. I just got the thing re-inked at the Office Depot, so I am ready. Don't bullshit me. Okay. You will get the stamp, and then you'll be able to sell it on eBay. Any other things you would like to bring up in the multiple choice section of this exam? Again, I'll do some quantitative types of things like relationship among DOL, DFL, and DCL. No question about that. I'll go through some questions about marginal cost of capital, conceptual questions of that nature. I could also ask you about the behavior of the price of a bond under different circumstances. For example, all other things being equal, what happens to the price of a bond as it approaches maturity? What happens to the price of a bond as it approaches maturity? Okay? I gave you a problem. Remember that quiz where I actually gave you the problem where I brought the bond in on its maturity and you saw what was happening to the price of the bond under those circumstances? That is something that would be very likely for me to ask you, is about that. I could also ask you more of an investment type of question. Well, what happens if the Federal Reserve does this? What would you anticipate would be the resulting reaction in bond markets? So right now, the Federal Reserve are fearless, nearly hairless leader Ben Bernanke announced that super accommodative monetary policy will continue. So what would that mean? What would you expect the bond markets to do if he were to say that? especially if they were scared that he was about to announce the end of super accommodative monetary policy. And then he steps up there and says, I'm still Uncle Sugar, and I'm going to still hand out candy. What do you suppose that would do to the bond markets? I'll give you that. I could give you that as either a multiple choice or a short answer question on the exam. Focusing now briefly, before I tell you too many questions in the multiple choice, focusing just for a second in the matching. Those are going to be like the ones before. You might see something like, I might give you a formula and match that to the name of what you're calculating. On the left side, you might see a formula. On the right side, find the what's the name of that formula. Okay, so I could say W sub D times KATD plus W sub S times K sub S. Okay, plus W sub N times K sub N. So let me write that down for you. You're looking at me like, can you say that again? Yeah, I might give you on one side W sub D, K A T sub D, plus W sub S, K sub S, plus W sub N times K sub N. And I say, oh, all right, now match that on the, what would you be looking for on the right side as the match? Talk to me. What would you be looking for on the right side that would be the match for that? Anything? This worries me. You need to study this weekend. That's whack. That's weighted average cost of capital. That's whack. Because you're actually calculating the weights times the costs of each component. So that's the weighted average cost of capital right there. Grr. Okay? Now, I can do some other things, too. There would be formulas that I would put. Some of the matching will just be formulas, and on the left side and on the right side, I'll give you a name, a bunch of names, and you find, you just simply match, what am I talking about here? I might give you one like this. What is that? What would that be? D sub 1 over the quantity P0 minus F. What is that? No, you're close. Not quite there. That's the cost of new equity. Get those down. Prep yourself so that you can do that with your eyes closed. Those are just straight match the name to the formula that I'm giving you. Now, that won't be all that I do there. I'll give you some other things on that part of the exam too, obviously, but on the matching. But I will put a couple of formulas. Go ahead.
We're still allowed to use the number.
Oh, absolutely. 4x6 all the time. And it's going to, you'll notice that it'll be packed with stuff, and don't write in micro print because I'm not going to read it to you because I can't see as well as you guys can. But, yeah, know your formulas, though. Make sure that you know what formula is what, because that's going to do you very good in other classes if you already know. Oh, okay, he's talking about weighted average cost of capital. I know what the formula is, and I can pull that out real fast and do something with it, okay? And also, I'm going to let you open it up for you. Do you have any questions, especially in matching kinds of context, what I could ask there? And remember, there are a lot of terms that I have used in this course. Those could show up, terminology can show up a lot of different places. In multiple choice, terminology could show up. In the matching, it could show up, or even in the short answers. A term, remember how you got hurt when I used had that question in the short answers about What the hell? Oh, term structure of an interest rate, or the risk structure of an interest rate. And a lot of you really felt around, but there was, in your notes, you could see there was a place where I said risk structure of an interest rate, and then I showed you the three parts of the risk structure of an interest rate. Make sure you know how to do that. If you see a specific term or word, you know that there is something specific I am looking for with regard to that term or word. Let me try this one. A periodic cash flow that continues forever. What would you say that is? Oh, I love it when you talk like, yes, it's a perpetuity. It's actually not hard, it's just one of the things. A level cash flow. Well, no, I'm reaching. I don't want to look. Well, okay. Okay, let me throw something else. The minimum of the weighted average cost of capital curve. What is that? Say it. Yeah, you could say it a little easier. Optimal capital structure. That would be, you're right though, you're absolutely right. That would be your optimal amount percent of debt, or you could just simply say, well, there's your optimal capital structure, where your weighted average cost of capital has bottomed out. That's optimal, as you said, and I did that with the percent as the percent of debt as the horizontal axis, but there's no question about it, that's the optimal percent of debt. And that obviously then means you know the optimal percent of equity, so you've got your optimal capital structure. And not bad, not bad. That's a reach. That's a little bit of a reach. Those are the kinds of things that I could be asking you in that regard. Just kind of quick pieces of information that are drawn from terminology that indicate to me that you've got a depth of knowledge of how the terminology relates to definitions and relates to the application of it. The discount rate at which NPV equals zero. Come on. What is that one? Say it. I thought you were being a pirate there for IRRRR. No, it's IRR, internal rate of return. Yeah, that's your internal rate of return. Two projects that cannot be both be accepted at in the same time frame. Love it. Yeah, we're getting life. Yes, indeed. Excellent. Not bad. Now, by the way, I had in my mind something that's a little bit not just a terminology kind of thing here, but do make sure you know what is the weakness. What are the weaknesses of internal rate of return? We obviously use it. It's important. In fact, you will notice in the textbook, I completely ignore some of the bull methods, payback period. I don't know why we even teach that method anymore. It is so worthless. But getting back to internal rate of return, our two big tools are NPV and IRR. Why is it that I talk about, well, if there's a conflict between results, we would go with the NPV results? And why is it? Why do I promote the idea that internal rate of return is weaker? Under what conditions could internal rate of return mislead you or give you a false answer? In fact, it can. Go ahead. Switch a sign. Say it. Yes. I'm trying to get you tightened up on your language. Yes. If the cash flow switches signs more than, bingo. Because obviously you're going to switch from negative to positive. You spend money, then you bring money in. That's how projects work. However, not all projects work so that you spend money and then you just take the money in. Sometimes a project, you spend money and then money comes in, and then you have to spend more money and then more money comes in. In a situation like that, internal rate of return has the nasty behavior of having more than one root. In other words, it crosses the horizontal axis more than once in discount rate NPV space. So make sure you know what that weakness is, because there are different ways that I could ask about that kind of a problem, that issue right there. What else do you want to know about? What's on the exam? Stop that. Give me some specifics. Fixed cost, variable cost. No. I will not. For one thing, that's too easy. For another thing, I always worry in the math section that's going to drag you down. And if you're going to do problems, I like to have you do things that show more muscle. So no, I will not do fixed cost, variable cost. Although I do reserve in possibly the multiple choice the right to talk about what the expected effect of larger fixed costs would be on degree of operating leverage. That I could do. That's actually a very easy question. I'm glad you brought that up. You got a good question out of me. Yeah, you had a question. Go ahead.
Are we going to have to calculate perpetuity?
No, you won't. Another one. You got me for another one. Say what?
Would you have to calculate annuities?
Well, yeah, you'll have to do annuities.
Because you said annuities and perpetuities.
Well, I'm going to ask you questions about perpetuities. Clearly, I would ask you a perpetuities type of question. And in fact, technically, when you're pricing stock or doing the pricing of a common stock, you're technically pricing a perpetuity because you're assuming the dividend goes on forever and ever and ever. So technically, I am sneaking in the perpetuity in that way. But directly saying, here's the perpetuity, find the price of it, no, I won't do that. Go ahead. Oh, that's a good question. I don't think I will. I'll give you discount rates. Because I did probe CAPM on the first exam. And I'll do that again on the final, but that's just an extra layer of calculation that could bog you down. I'm glad you asked that. No, I'll give you discount rates. Now, obviously, some places you'll have to find the discount rate. That's what we call finding the yield. But in terms of actually calculating a discount rate from CAPM, not on this exam. Good question, though. Yeah. More in this exam, you'll have the pieces, and what you're going to do is put the bigger pieces together and then just get the puzzle solved for me. And I won't give you a lot of pieces to work with to get to the problem-solving stage of the to the final stage of the problem-solving process, because there's just 60 minutes to do the exam. And so you don't have a lot of time to play with all kinds of complicated little pieces to get to your answer. The worst of it, of course, is that one where you do the marginal cost of capital, because you've got to do the cost of the components, then you've got to go through and do your breakpoints, and then you've got to go through and do your MCCs. Now, let me try something on you. Okay. If there are two breakpoints, how many marginal costs of capital are there? Huh? Say it.
Three.
Bingo. Three. Good. Now, what's another name for the first marginal cost of capital? Come on. So say it. Don't be afraid. Say it loudly into the microphone.
Weighted
so the
average cost of capital.
Yes, you're being listened to by people all over the world. The guy that just said that is a handsome, upstanding young stud, and he was afraid that if he said it out loud and he got it right, he would get too many offers of marriage from women around the world. So, ladies, if you want to know about him, send me an email, and I'll send you a picture of him for a modest fee. Excellent, though. Excellent. That's exactly right. It's a whack. The first MCC is always whack. They hook up and then the MCC drops under and then lifts back through it. It's kind of a pretty graph when you do these. In some classes, not this one, but if you took them just the next level up in this, I'd show you how to do these on your calculator and see the graphs of these curves, how they behave. They're actually kind of interesting to look at, just from a management perspective, to see what the behavior of your costs of capital are in a theoretical, and then apply that to a practical context. Other questions that you want to ask me? Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Someone give that man a cookie, because he hit one of my questions very close. Oh, yeah. Let's get that one more time. What was your question?
Why would companies issue equity if it's more expensive than debt?
Very good. Very good. And also, I will reach back a little bit. Now, I do try to cabin each exam so that it's just the content of that part of the course. And I leave for the final, the comprehensive. But there is bleed over. There's bleed over. There's a related question to what you asked. It has to do with, why is debt less expensive than equity? What is it about debt that makes it cheaper than equity? Now, there are two reasons for that. And that's all I'm going to go. That's all the further I'm going to go. But there are two reasons, two large reasons. The debt is cheaper than equity for a company. And that flows into the next question. Okay, well, if it's cheaper, then why the hell would companies issue equity? And this leads us to the Modigliani-Miller proposition. That at the end of the day, there's an answer to Modigliani-Miller that's technical, but underneath it, there is a little bit less technical issue involved too. M&M is, the proposition is false on several grounds, and it was a tribute to them. Like I said, they're not stupid. They were academics of the highest caliber, but what they were doing was challenging us to say, all right, what our assumptions tell us leads to something we don't see. So why don't we see it? And, of course, there is the one technical aspect. Why is debt cheaper? And why might it not always, forever be cheaper? But then there's another question in there, too. Why would companies issue equity if it's more expensive than debt? Clearly, maybe debt does go above the cost of equity at some point. Sure. But there's some other, clearly, when debt is cheaper than equity, companies are still issuing equity. Why would that be? Even when debt is cheaper than equity, and we might say, yeah, debt could get more expensive than equity if the company gets very risky, but when a company still is in a low debt position, debt is obviously cheaper than equity, but we still see companies issuing common stock and having stockholders. Why could they be doing that? What would be the reason for doing that? And this goes to another question too. Why do companies issue dividends? What's the point of a dividend, for God's sake? I mean, obviously internally generated equity is what the company can use for new investments. We saw that in those investment opportunity schedule marginal cost of capital problems. Obviously, the company, if it keeps the net income, then obviously that's available to spend on new projects, and that's less that they have to run out and get new capital from external markets. But we still see companies issuing dividends. Why? Well, there's a classical reason. Well, the company might feel that its investors could get a higher rate of return with the money than the company could. That's just plain horseshit. Because that's a technical term, by the way. If the company is a functioning going concern, You're telling me that the company doesn't have any projects it could take on that would be better than its investors could do, than its shareholders can do? Any company that would come to me and tell me that, I'd say, I don't want to invest in you. You don't have any creativity at all, that you can't think of some way to make a decent buck off the money that you're generating as net income. You want to give it back to me? Please, keep it. Get to work. Find something to do with that money that earns good return. Okay, I'm taking you in. There's a reason for that, because I will probe that, at least in a small way on the exam, the concept of dividends and the plowback ratio and all of that kind of stuff in some way. Okay, what else do you want to ask me about? Do you have any other questions for me? Go ahead. A what?
Profit by using the total revenue and total cost?
No, not exactly. No. That would go sort of like to the break. You'll have to do a break even. Don't get me wrong. And that would mean that you'd have to know total revenue and total cost, but just to calculate a pure profit, no. But only in the context of a break even type of problem would I do that. And I might very well, instead of putting that in the workout problem section, I might put that in the multiple choice problem. I'll just say, well, here's total, here's your variable cost, here's your fixed cost, and so which of the following is your break-even output level? And just A, B, C, D. I might just throw that into that section. Again, there will be a little bit more quantitative aspect to this multiple choice section than there was on the first exam. And then the final will be a blending of the two approaches. What else do you have for me? Anything? It's your call. Go ahead.
For the narrative, is there going to be what percent is going to be on there compared to what you're going to give us on the test?
Explain.
Are you going to give us everything on the narrative?
Well, not the answer, for God's sake. I mean, I was bored at night, but it wasn't last night. I'm going to give you everything you need to do the calculations. I won't give you the cost, but obviously to find MCCs, breakpoints, you have to find cost of capital. You have to find the cost of the different capital components. And so I would give you all of the money, all of the numbers you would need to get the costs, and then from there you would be able to get clearly to your breakpoints, as long as I told you what your net income was, what your dividend cost was going to be. And remember, there are different ways that I can tell you the dividend. First, I can tell you next year's dividend or this year's dividend. But I can also give you the dividend in terms of the number of shares outstanding and the dollar value of the dividend. I could do it to you that way. But remember, I also did it the other way, where I just simply told you the dividend ratio of the company, the payout ratio of the company. That was the other way I can give you the dividend of it. So in one way, I could say, well, net income next year is expected to be $2 million. The dividend payout ratio is 20%. Well, okay. Then how much is the dividend? What's the cost of the dividend to the company? Okay, let me do that one again. The net income was $2 million. This company has a dividend payout ratio of 20%. So what is the amount of the dividend that they are going to pay? $400,000. So how much are they going to have left for new projects internally? What's their earnings? What's their retained earnings? How much? Yeah, 1.6. Okay, good. Very good. Okay, now, I was talking about that dividend. Was I talking about D0 or D1 in that narrative, oral narrative I just gave you? D1. I said the dividend, the net income next year is expected to be. So I was talking about calculations that would be forward one period. So it's D1 I was talking about there, not D0. So if it had been D0, you would have had to do the 1 plus the growth rate to get D1. But if I say next year, that means that I've already done the D1, the calculation for you. But if I said the net income they just generated was, then you'd be in the context of D0 there. Okay? Just remember that. That's one of the twists that can happen. And I gave it to you both ways in different problem contexts. So there's a little bit of an effort in this exam to have you look for the nuance of the wording. Not terribly, because I mean I can get knocked dead with nuance and wording of questions. Hell, that's why I never did LSAT, But I will give you some nuance in that regard. Next year versus this year. What am I talking about kind of thing? Go ahead.
What are we doing next Thursday?
I'm giving you back to the exam. Yeah. And that's it.
Oh, what?
Well, it depends on how important you see as passing exam, too. Well, let me tell you, the grading them is a marathon. And if you go late night to Denny's, you might very well see me sitting there with a cup of coffee and at 1 o'clock in the morning, kill them all, let God sort them out. But that's the way I do it. I just plow. And one of the worst things that can happen is if you break and then go back and start grading again, your whole grading pattern changes. I've seen that. I've taught for 30 years. I mean, at the first round, I might just kill everyone on a question for a small error. And then if I go out and I've had a nice meal, then I go back and start grading 2 hours later, that was a little mistake. And so I have to keep pushing all one swat. Otherwise, the grading pattern changes on me, and then some people get better grades than others. But don't bother me at Denny's, for God's sake. You don't like me in that mode. What else do you have for me? Because I'm done with what I will tell you now. But if you have anything else you want to ask me, and if you listen carefully to this podcast and look at your notes from here, I've told you a lot about this exam. You should all get very high grades, 100% in fact. Well, perhaps not 100%. And if you do, I'll knock off a couple of points just to put you back down to size. You have any other questions? Okay, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.